Committee on Oil and Gas will now come to order at 5:03 PM. With us today are Representative Dugan, Representative Ramrus, Representative Samuels, Representative Kawasaki. Representative Holmes is a guest of the committee, but sitting at the table with us, and myself, Co-Chair Olson. We have one item on the agenda today, which is presentation by Oil and Gas, and I'd like Kevin Banks to come up and introduce his staff. And I think we'll hold off on questions until the end of the presentation, just to speed up the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Banks, and I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Oil and Gas at DNR. With me today are Kurt Gibson, the Acting Deputy Director, and Julie Hool, directly behind me, is the head of our Resources Section, our Chief Geologist. And today I have a presentation about the first 16 or so slides in here is all that I'm going to speak to today. The rest of the packet, I've included a good deal of information in an appendix. I think that's probably an appropriate way to give you as much information for you to have now, and then offer our staff for your pleasure to contact us, get it filled in with more information, and I hope we can have a few more conversations individually and here with the committee as time goes on, so you can learn to know more about us. The Division of Oil and Gas gets its mission statement basically from the Constitution. Section 8 says that we must develop our resources for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans, and that's precisely, you see all of those words in our mission statement as well. And I'll speak to that in terms of what we call our core services. We're supposed to encourage development and exploration in Alaska. I mean, that is a major part of what we do. And I'll talk a little bit about how we do that in addition to who we are trying to bring into the state. Maximize revenue for oil and gas. And I've told some people in the last few hours why revenue, in my view, is at first the best measure of whether or not we're really maximizing benefits. And then maximizing the benefits of development and production goes to those other economic spin-offs, jobs and new industrial and commercial and service kinds of businesses that spin off of a resource industry like oil and gas. I would say among these three, it would be great if every time you had a decision to make about an application for a unit or an expansion of a participating area or in offering leases for sale, that these didn't conflict. But they sometimes do. Sometimes in order to maximize revenues, we may be accused of discouraging development because we're pressing too hard for revenues over and above what industry would like in the way of incentives. And similarly, jobs can take a very important role. It's very important, I know, to all of you. However, we have to measure, in my opinion, what kinds of incentives, what are we doing to balance the benefits of industrial growth, of economic growth, against what the state can offer and put into the game, so to speak, in the form of changing our revenue stream. It's important also to realize that you are the board of directors of the fourth largest producer in the North Slope, or in Alaska. And that's what this table on page 4 illustrates. We're not only the fourth largest producer, but we're also four times larger than the next one, Anadarko. It means that the state of Alaska has a very important role in the North American energy market. People are aware of us. They're keeping an eye on us. I think many of you are familiar with statistics that show that 25% of domestic production comes from Alaska, that about 10 to 12% of U.S. consumption of oil comes from Alaska, that our reserves represent an enormous percentage of the undeveloped reserves around the country. And we in the Division of Oil and Gas are the land managers of this energy position. There aren't too many organizations in North America that are like us. What comes to mind is the Minerals Management Service, Canadian government. I can't think of another state that has a ownership position like Alaska does for its oil lands. And for that reason, it's extremely important that you all realize that we should be managing these resources proactively and with a responsibility for maximizing benefits for all Alaskans. And that's the focus that I certainly wish to see our division remain right head up, right in front of us for every kind of activity we participate in. The state's revenue picture is illustrated on page 5. Basically, in fiscal year 06, $2.4 billion came into the state from the land resource in our position as the land manager. About $600 million of that went directly into the permanent fund, and the remaining $1.8 billion, it represents contributions to the general fund. Taxes in the same period at $1.9 billion. These are in 06 revenues from the severance tax, production tax. I'd like to point out, as I think it's important to recognize, next year it's forecasted by the Department of Revenue that their revenue stream from the production profits tax, that their revenues will increase to something like $2.8 billion. So they're going to nearly add another close to $1 billion on top of the current revenue stream as a result of the PPT. That's their prediction now. I would submit that we are in an experimental phase with PPT, and I would like to point out to you that in estimating the revenue from production taxes, it's no longer an exercise of guessing the price or predicting price, knowing something about future volume, and then calculating a production revenue, tax revenue, which in fact that's how we would predict our royalty revenue. Now we have several more variables to account for. What kind of tax credits are available? What kind of expenditures are the industry going to book as write-offs against production tax? And what is the response of new development given those kinds of incentives and the functioning of the production tax, the profits tax, in terms of their decision making to bring on new oil and gas resources into development? It means then, I think, that the Division of Oil and Gas now is responsible for a somewhat more predictable and perhaps less volatile stream of revenue. Our revenue picture for oil and gas is illustrated. Now, these are strictly revenues that come from our land position, royalties, rents, and bonuses, and oil and gas settlements. And you can see we've done very well in the last few years as the run-up in price has saved us from a decline in a bit of a decline in production. I'd like to point out in this graph, just to make one mention of this fact. In fiscal year 06, I've made the point, $1.9 billion from tax. Here you see the $2.4 billion from royalties. And another graph, I'm sure this is comes as no surprise, we show the decline in royalty production during the same period. And thank goodness for high prices, we've been able to significantly overwhelm the decline. And the a piece of information I want you to take away here is what's happened as a result of our royalty in kind oil program. In fiscal year 06, we show about 39 million barrels a day, I'm sorry, 39 million barrels flowing down the pipeline. About 60% of that amount, this is our royalty picture, about 60% of that nearly 40 million barrels of oil, royalty oil, was sold to Flint Hills Resources. So I keep in mind that we are now putting a fairly large egg in one basket with Flint Hills, whereas before the sales of royalty were quite a bit less than that historically. And I can add also that the percentages are increasing as the flow of oil continues to decline and our share and the royalty share declines as well. So in order to meet the requirements of that contract in the future, we'll be taking a larger percentage of our royalty oil to supply the contract with Flint Hills.
Director Banks, could I interrupt you for a minute?
Yes, you may.
I'd like to acknowledge that we've been joined by Representative Fairclough, Representative Dahlstrom, and Representative Book. And for the members that have come in after the opening, we're going to be taking the questions at the end to allow the process to speed up. So we're out of here before 7 p.m. tonight. Thanks a lot, Director.
Thank you, sir. Now I'll speed it up a bit. I think we can move on. I'd like to talk just briefly about our organization. We think of ourselves as organized in a very similar way as any exploration and production company. We have the same kinds of staff and skill sets and expertise within the division, starting out with resource evaluation. This is the staff that Ms. Houle is the chief. We have on staff folks that have extensive experience in industry that have chosen to come to work for the state because of the challenge and for the ability to basically be on the edge, where in a much larger organization they may not have that kind of career opportunity, I think. So there's a number of geologists, geophysicists, and other geotechnical scientists that work for us who are very good. And as Julie will be happy to remind you, we have frequently been in situations where in a presentation made by an oil company, some staffer from the oil company will be making some presentation about the geology or the geophysics of the of an area. Person arrived 2 or 3 years ago from Houston, is now working this prospect, doing a great job, and meeting up with someone in our office who points out and says, have you included the seismic line that was shot in 1989 or something like that? You have it, we know you have it, and we know what it looks like. And so it's a small advantage. We need to play it out as best as we can. I mean, we have very good people working there, and we do bring to the table a fair amount of information and history. These are the very same people that worked for these companies years ago and are now with us. Leasing and permitting is another section in our division. Last year, we raised almost $40 million in bonuses. That was over five sales, I believe, in that same period. And we are now, as most of you are familiar, running a very routine, regular offering of land in the state in lease sales that are held every year. Two on the there's Beaufort Sea, North Slope, and the foothills. We sell a sale in Cook Inlet, and now most recently we've added the Alaska Peninsula, Bristol Bay area as a sale area. And those, we are offering lands on a routine basis. Our clients can expect and plan for those lease sales when they occur. Unit administration is perhaps where the real rubber meets the road. After you've offered a lease, and companies begin establishing a land position in order to explore and subsequently develop the resource, the effort then becomes to bring together the owners of all of the various leases that they may be on. Our job is to protect the correlative rights of all of those owners, to encourage the economic and physical development of all the resources in the area by aggregating these land positions and managing them as a unit. We have a fairly small staff. Among that staff are engineers and lawyers, and we have quite a lot of activity in that is generated in the management of these units and forming participating areas over new pools as they are discovered, contracting the units if need be, or conversely expanding units to include larger pools. Royalty accounting, it's the folks that make sure that the money we're receiving is accounted for correctly and deposited in the right places. And audit is a function that the legislature returned to the Department of Natural Resources a few years ago, and which we are finally staffed up for and are able now to conduct our own audits. Previous to that time, we were had to depend on the audit capabilities of Department of Revenue, and in our opinion, often had to worked into their schedule to make sure that our audits were conducted on time. These audits are now producing the fruits of a fairly aggressive program, and we are slowly but steadily catching up on a quite a backlog of audits of royalty revenues. I might also add that the royalty valuation mechanisms that we use are governed by royalty settlement agreements as that are a consequence of the Emirata Hess royalty North Slope royalty dispute of years ago, initiated in 1977 and finally concluded with the majors by about 1995. If you want to hear a treatise on how they work, I'd be happy to give it to you, but it's a complication. We have bilateral agreements with each of our major ANS North Slope producers in the calculation of their royalty value. And our auditors also work with our commercial section to validate those numbers and to explore how those royalty settlement agreements are working and whether or not we are getting the fair value for our royalty as a result. That brings us to the commercial section. It's again a relatively small staff of people with experience in economics, in a fair amount of business acumen. And these are the folks that have insinuated themselves into the decision-making process throughout the division with the expressed intention to bring value to the state by finding those opportunities, those commercial opportunities when they arise, and to make sure that the state is exercising to the best of our ability the leverage that we can when someone comes and asks for something from us. Several issues are on the table, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about this quite a bit this year. North Slope Gas Pipeline, AGEA, Point Thompson Unit is ongoing. You'll be hearing from us with respect to what had been monikered the LAMECO is now, I think, better called Systems Integrity, and how we intend to manage that so that the facilities, oil facilities and flow lines and such on the North Slope are managed and maintained. And then there'll be some, I'm sure, discussion about ongoing audits and re-evaluations of royalty value and the like that arise out of the management of our royalty settlement agreements. Longer-term issues. It's an old saw, but you know we've been looking at decline for quite a while, and this is where the state and the division, on behalf of the state, has an opportunity to make sure that there's access to our lands and to foster development. This is the first of those core services I mentioned. This is where we have to provide information outreach to new producers, new players in the business, to, as I said, make sure land is available, to manage those units and lands that are already under lease effectively, and make sure that in return for for the land holding that a lessee has, they respond with a commitment to get to work and produce our resources. And lastly, we'll hear more about facility access, I think, as the session wears on. It's very tough not to crack, in my opinion. We would like to see commercial solutions to these kinds of issues where independents or those who have need of facilities can make fair and equitable commercial deals with those who own the facilities so that new oil fields can be brought on at the most efficiently and at the most cost-effective way. And I believe that's all I would like to touch on for you today. I know it's late, and love to take any questions. And as I said, there's a great deal more information in this packet. And if that should generate more questions than we can do today, by all means, give us a call.
Representative Ramirez, the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three questions, please. We retroactive PPT back to April 1, but PPT was settled when the end of June, is that right? What kind of new activity have we seen from large or small producers that was spurred by the PPT since that period of time?
Then I have Representative Ramirez, through the chair, I think it's too soon to tell. We've certainly seen a good deal, a real bump up in activity in both the North Slope and in the Cook Inlet. There's fairly aggressive drilling programs going on right now on the North Slope, but I think that was more a consequence of higher oil prices and also some limited supply of other opportunities, and folks are coming back to Alaska as a consequence. But theoretically, I would say, and in the analysis and the work that we've done on PPT with respect to a couple of royalty modification applications that we received in the last 12 months, and then also the some of the modeling that we've done for the gas line, we see that the state is participating in a very big way in new investments.
Let me thank you very much, Mr. Rickner, through the chair. The complexion of the new development, is it Conoco and BP, or is it the small producers, which is who we had hoped to attract with the PPT, some of the new guys, the independent drillers? That was one of the pinnacle pieces of the effort.
Well, let me try to answer that this way, Representative Ramirez and Mr. Chairman. We see Conoco Phillips is taking a fairly a big role in, say, NPRA, and they're pursuing that. BP is working its role as an operator, both in Prudhoe Bay and other units, in a big way, new investments there. Much of the new exploration activity on state lands is being generated by independents, and I think we should be pretty excited about, say, Ugarook and Pioneer's activities there. I read just last night that they're ordering up 12 modules from that will be built here in the state for that.
But through the chair, just a point, Ugarook was already on the books. I was interested in a new activity. I'd appreciate it if oil and gas could provide that information to me, specifically what is the name of the companies and what activity has been stimulated since PPT was passed. Secondly, and in light of the governor's State of the State address, when we open up the envelope on March 31st, if the right sum of money isn't there, does oil and gas have a plan immediately to introduce to the legislature to remedy the potential for big oil to have gamed us through the PPT? And the second part of that question is, do we have an estimate of the deferred maintenance for BP, not only to rehabilitate the inline transmission lines up north, but also their global and North American reputation? As I sat next to us at Pike's Landing, Mr. Chairman, not to give a plug-in for a very good restaurant bar, but I sat next to a contract worker for ASRC, And he said, oh, yeah, BP's going to be doing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of work. And a lot of that work is deferred maintenance, you know, that predates PPT. And I'm assuming that, I've been told specifically in this hallway by one of their best people that they will take all the opportunities that the law allows to write off those costs, which I, of course, I suggested was good in the near term and poor planning in the long term if they abuse the good graces of the state of Alaska. I don't want to confuse my questions, but if you could just kind of give me a broad answer to those concerns and those questions.
Well, I'll try to boil it down to this, Representative Robbins, through the chair. To answer the first question, what will happen on March 31st when TARA opened the envelope? Frankly, the Division of Oil and Gas has not begun thinking about or working on a potential solution for that problem. I know that in conversations I've had with folks at the Department of Revenue, they want to monitor what's going to be happening and what they can expect. As far as the level of activity, the kinds of gamesmanship that may occur, I really don't know quite how to respond to that, to be quite frank with you. At the moment, for the existing players, you know, the role of the division is to make sure that our royalties are at least getting paid. And I think we can offer our facilities and our capabilities to the Department of Revenue with respect to the kinds of resources that folks are after in a more prospective way, and the kinds of how investment credits and so forth are being spent for that kind of thing. I think we're going to find that the full story of PPT may be a bit hard to tell that quickly. I appreciate the difficulty of and the problem that you've defined in your question, and it's a we'll see.
Through the chair, excellent answer. Thank you very much. I appreciate your candor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, thank you. I believe, without putting words in our chairman's mouth, that we can probably get revenue down here for an afternoon to answer a good portion of those questions. I would suspect they'd be delighted to come down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Or if not delighted, at least they'll show up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I've got at least two questions for you, one of which would be, can you tell us what's going on in the Nanana Basin? And or we'll start with that one.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad I was asked that question not about an hour ago, so maybe I'll have some kind of answer for you, sir. Nanana Basin is the exploration license was offered to Andex, and I think one of the native corporations is participating there. There's been very little activity in recently there. I think the rest of the answer and the better part of the story is something I'd like to be able to share with you in writing as we move forward.
Yeah, would you like to respond?
Bob is. He could respond. He's here.
Thank you, Julie. Would you like to hear what Bob Swenson has to say about it?
How about letting me get one more from you, and then we'll get Bob up.
Very good.
The second one would be is what kind of negative impact you see in Cook Inlet as a result of the RCA decision, the recent decision? Is that going to have an impact on future exploration in the near term, or am I just getting nervous?
I think it's probably appropriate, Mr. Chairman, to be a little nervous. I understand that. I want to handle this rather delicately because the division has been tasked by the governor to examine the problem. We've certainly done in the last several years made predictions about the demand and supply situation in the Cook Inlet with respect to gas. The market is starting to coalesce in a very interesting way where you have the LNG exports, contracts expiring for Chugach and NSTAR, and so now, in the first time in a long time, you have demand sort of articulating itself in the market, people looking for supplies of gas where that hadn't occurred before. And was the price of the NSTAR Marathon contract the right price? I would have to say, in my own opinion, the a the historical prices that consumers in the Cook Inlet have enjoyed are not high enough to bring in new gas supplies. We've seen some response to higher gas prices, say, as a result of the earlier NSTAR Unocal contract, in my opinion, to set the stage for new exploration and further development of existing resources there. And I think we need to expect that that will be the case in the future.
Oh, thank you.
Could I ask a follow-up?
Certainly.
That, Mr. Chairman. Do you mean to say that even though my gas bill has doubled in the past 6 months, that isn't a high enough price to support new exploration in Cook Inlet?
The price that the consumer, Representative Dugan, through the chair, is largely the result of historical contracts that have been indexed to oil. And so the balance of, or the weighting of the gas that you're getting at your house is still largely being supplied by fairly old long-term contracts whose prices were set by the price of oil. And so as we've seen a huge run-up in price of oil in the last several years, that's finally showing up in those contracts. Price of oil may obviously decline. The newer contracts, the kinds of contracts that NSTAR and Marathon were trying to get through the RCA, the earlier NSTAR Unocal contract, were driven by the price of gas in the lower 48 as measured at a pricing point called Henry Hub in Louisiana, which reflects, in a sense, what the market is for Gulf of Mexico gas coming into the lower 48 market. So insofar, I would say this about that. We've enjoyed fairly reasonable prices, comfortable prices for gas, because as long as oil was running at $20 a barrel, we didn't have to pay very much. If new supplies of gas are set at a price commensurate with what those old contracts are now generating for a price, the answer might be yes, that could be high enough. That at $7.50 an MCF, say, for example, for the consumer in Anchorage, that might convert to a price sufficiently high to encourage development. It's a question that I can't answer without better data and a better opportunity to give you a more reasonable and reasoned response. Higher gas prices in the Cook Inlet will yield more activity. I think that is a fair assumption. And the mechanism that is most often discussed is that you have to draw investment dollars out of the lower 48 and into the Cook Inlet. And if folks in the Gulf of Mexico can get a $7.50 price at the, you know, very near to the wellhead in Louisiana, maybe that is the right price to use here in the Cook Inlet. There are certainly a lot of places in the lower 48 where they're getting paid less than that, in the Rockies, even in Alberta. So, and there's certainly a lot of development there. So something has to change in these new contracts, tying it to a gas price that's different than what we're paying now is probably the right way what the market should do. And I'll add just one other thing. Gas supplies that we are now using in the Cook Inlet were found as a consequence, mainly, in the search of oil. And so setting the price of gas to an oil price had some logic. Now I think we need to set the price against some measure of gas prices elsewhere, because the target is gas.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. I guess we'll
think we're going to have a second.
You want to hear from
Jason? Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you're great. I think we're going to speak out,
your
Bob.
Friend right behind you there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And could you introduce yourself for the record?
For the record, my name is Bob Swenson. I'm the state geologist and acting director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And through the chair, your question relating to the Nanana Basin. I think just a real brief history on the Nanana Basin. There were two wells drilled in the 1980s. There was some indication of hydrocarbons in those wells in the form of what we call shows. There is some very limited seismic data, some reflection seismology data in the basin, and from that there was a exploration license that was granted to Andex Corporation. Since that time, they had included in some additional partners in that work. One of the work commitments that they had on that exploration license was to shoot additional seismic. The basin, from a standpoint of geology, is very, very complex. Excuse me, I'm getting a cold. And the structure is the trap that the hydrocarbons would be reservoired in are fairly complex. That's why their work commitment included that additional seismic work. And they did that. They went out and shot that seismic, I think it was a winter ago. They got that data back, and they initially had a well plan for the basin following that seismic work. And they were shooting that seismic over a prospect they'd already had identified. And when they got the seismic back, and of course this is all hearsay from this point forward, they decided not to drill in that place, and they felt that it was better that they looked at that seismic data much better, or in much more detail, and they have not suggested where they may drill again. And so I think it's fair to say that what they found in the new seismic data, the more modern seismic data, is that the geology is very complex, and that I think they're still analyzing whether the reserves that they could expect in one of these prospects are large enough to warrant a well. And we have not heard back any other additional information from that since that seismic data was shot.
Well, while we have you up here, how about the two test wells at Red Dog? Do I have any results on wells up north?
Yes, I do not know the results of the wells, and that you're talking about the shale gas wells for the mine. I don't have the results from that. I can get that information and send that to you.
Oh, be appreciated.
Yeah,
you bet. Send it to Chairman Coring, and he'll get it out to us.
Okay, very good. I do have one additional comment on the Cook Inlet, if I may, Chairman. It has to do with Representative Dugan's question, and I'll jump in here, Kevin, if you'd like. One other big issue here, of course, is swing. And when I say swing, any given market, if you have a continuous demand with no variation in demand, that's much better than if you have a very high spike in that demand. And that's one of the issues to the local market in the Cook Inlet. If you're a producer, you'd like to be producing continuously through time the same amount. Unfortunately, because we're at it's essentially a closed market, except for the export, the closed market in the basin, the demand for gas in the wintertime is three times as great as the demand in the summertime. And so that market, the price of your gas, if even though it goes up in the NSTAR market, there's such a high swing in it, in that deliverability, that it will spur exploration, but the market is relatively limited. And so it does hold back some exploration in the basin.
You're awfully quiet today. Well, any other questions for Mr. Swenson? Representative Bremers.
I'll go last, Mr. Chairman.
Pardon me?
I'll go last.
I think you are last.
Okay. Okay, let's go back to the Nanana Basin.
Sure.
Let's go back to the governor's State of the State address. She said, we're going to commission DNR to go out there and find new energy and get it to communities that need it. And so I'd like to tell you about a friend of mine who wanted to date one of two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
One sister was beautiful. The other sister was Miss USA. And he just couldn't bring himself to date the beautiful sister, because Miss USA was just stunning. And and our friends at Andex they're a small cap company. They've got leases in the Gulf of Mexico, which is the best place to do a oil and gas lease, certainly in North America, in the state of Alaska, and they are not
very motivated to participate in gas exploration in Alaska, no matter how beautiful their Alaskan sister is, if you accept my analogy, because it,
sure.
because the Gulf of Mexico is Miss America. And the governor said that she was going to look for energy, she was going to inventory it, task DNR with finding it. We think that there that the geology mirrors the Cook Inlet geology, complex as it may be. What specific steps are oil and gas going to take to energize Andex? You know, we've been going through our 23rd plan of development with ExxonMobil, and we finally had the courage to step up there and make some affirmative efforts, which I support. And what are we going to do the same thing there? You could change the economy for 90,000 people in the interior of Alaska, and buying a gas treatment plant off the shelf right there in that area, you could change energy dynamics up and down the Yukon River with methane, propane, every, you know, A&E that that they make. And so I appreciate the passive approach that was acceptable under the Murkowski administration when we were stalking an elephant. But I want to know what we're doing now when we're looking for small game and a few hundred BCF in the basin would change energy economics in a giant circle around Nenana. That's my question.
All right. Representative Remmers, through the chair. I'm glad you brought this up. Appreciate that. We actually have been starting on a program to look at the energy resources across the state. And I will go statewide and then move into the Nenana Basin. The issue anywhere in the state right now is the cost of diesel, of course. It's driving a lot of problems economically for most all the villages, of course, and in many communities. There's been a tremendous amount of work done around the state trying to understand what sources are available. Unfortunately, that the compilation of that in any given area has not really been done. And so this inventory, what our plan is here, this inventory, what we'll want to do is to go into each area and understand not only the geologically related resources, whether it be coal, geothermal, natural gas, shallow natural gas, coal bed methane, but also include all the renewables. And so working with AEA, and we're working on a letter of agreement with AEA to get their data and incorporate it into this statewide issue, and also include with the Division of Forestry all biomass. And what our plan is that we will end up with a map of the entire state that has, excuse me, GIS layers, if you will, and of each individual resource that we know of. And so it will include, and you can take, therefore, go to that map, interactive map, and say, okay, here at this village, what are the possible resources that are available, including wind, including hydro, including all the renewables, and as well as any coal, and then also put in that the economics of that. Now, that comes back around to the Nenana Basin. The potential for gas in the Nenana Basin is certain. There is, you know, there's a number of coals within the section. The entire Cook Inlet is all the gas, or 95% of the gas, is what we call biogenic, so essentially based from those coals or generated in those coals. The Nenana Basin has that same stratigraphy. It's nowhere near as thick as the Cook Inlet, but there still is that potential there. And as far as spurring that exploration, I think that really was the idea of the exploration licensing. They didn't have, there was very little money that was up front, like you'd go to a lease sale and give a bonus. And what they did was is give a work commitment, and they would outline that work commitment over a number of years. Each year, once they got that work commitment done, they had the ability to take that very large acreage that they were able to do exploration on, and no one else was able to come in, and then pare that down to a specific area where they wanted to actually have a prospect, and then go to lease on that. That excuse me. That is where the first work commitment on the Nenana Basin was done. They satisfied what they suggested they were going to do. The next work commitment, as I understand, is a well. If they don't do that work commitment, then that entire license will come back. And please correct me on that, Kevin, if I'm not right. But I'm quite sure that they had a well in that work commitment. And we can get details on that for you later. The litmus test, if you will, on that is, you know, each company is going to have their own baseline economics. And I, if I remember right, there was, I think they were in the TCF range of gas for them to be able to do the exploration, shoot the seismic, drill the well, and build the pipeline. And they had to have a certain size of field. In their second round, or in that round of geophysics that they shot, if the prospects that they that came out of that did not meet their economic hurdle, then I would, there would be likely that they would say, okay, we need to relook at this. And I think that's where they're at right now, is they're looking at the size of the prize may have shrunk on them, but I don't know the answer to that. The future of the Nanana Basin, I think, is, I think exploration licensing is a very, very good way to go in these very high-risk areas. If they decide not to move forward with their work commitment, then that opens it up for another company, and they, that other company may or may not have additional or a different economic analysis on that. What the state can do is to gather additional data, and that's one of the key issues. Unfortunately, we will not have access to the new seismic data. That's proprietary with ANDEX. But there is a lot of things that we can do, and that's additional mapping, additional surface mapping, try to understand exactly what the size of this of the prize is in that basin, and then put that publicly and try to attract additional customers.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up, just to put it on the record.
Sure.
Part of the problem with the mechanics that you described, and you're dead on, and you're an expert, and I have a great deal of respect for you and your whole department. It was an excellent presentation today, and I thank you very much. Is that the Fairbanks market, as it is a very immature, fuel-based market that is presently 0.6 of 1B. Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, yeah. From sitting in this room with the chairman and a gentleman to his right, is that they were waiting to nominate gas into a much larger pipe. And the economics of the Fairbanks market are never going to justify the scope of an operation that you say, whether these folks hold the lease or whether you sell it for a dollar to the next guy that holds the lease, but it doesn't answer the charge that the governor gave to all of us in her state of the state, which is, I'm going to locate energy and I'm going to get it to the communities that need it. And I am in a community, with all respect to Representative Dugan, my community is paying $16.80 per MCF for natural gas. That's the equivalent of $2.55 for heating oil. And my friends to the south spend half the BTUs to heat the same size house that I have, and I'm paying twice as much per BTU. And I was one of the things I was happiest to hear from the governor. And I want a plan. I want to hear about a plan that delivers gas, if it's there, to my community 50 miles away. That's mm-hmm. what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in the economics of getting an economic volume of gas to a large market like Alberta or Chicago. I'm interested in getting some gas in a 12-inch line from Nanana to Fairbanks so that I can deliver cost-effective energy to the people that I represent in the interior of Alaska, as well as NSTAR's interest in moving that gas from Nanana down. We all participated in passing a resolution, Mr. Chairman, out of this committee to help them get $3 million from the feds to do the engineering. There are three right-of-ways that exist along that area, I'm just exasperated because we've been talking about it for 2 years, and you're dead on in everything that you say, but so am I.
Mm-hmm.
And ANDEX is an out-of-state entity that hasn't done a damn thing here except played a mini ExxonMobil, and it irritates me. And I'd like to see that with a new governor and a new plan and where smaller game is available to shoot at instead of just, you know, stalking big elephants, that we try and think out of the box and get some of that cheap gas to my community. Thank you for letting me get on my soapbox, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it a lot.
Representative Samuels?
Thanks. I got a follow-up on that, actually, on the State of the State speech. How much of the $150 million are you going to absorb?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
How much of the $150 million is oil and gas going to absorb?
Mm. Through the chair, Representative Samuels.
So that Representative Ramos gets gas.
Yes.
Good question. Through the chair.
I don't know that. I don't know the answer to it. I do know that they're looking at, you know, cuts across the board for the $150 million. However, at the House Finance Subcommittee today, Commissioner Rutherford suggested that she was much more interested in programs And if we are forced to cut the budget for Department of Natural Resources, what she told us was that she's much more interested in programs, but those programs have not been identified.
In eliminating programs?
Eliminating programs.
Well, if there are no further questions, I'd like to get Director Banks up to introduce the rest of his members of his staff, and also for the people on the committee or in the room that haven't had the pleasure of working with your people to maybe briefly tell us what they do and what we should contact them with if we have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the end of this row is Marie Crosley. She's our legislative liaison and definitely the right-hand woman in our staff. It's just a wonderful asset for the division. Kurt Gibson is the acting deputy director. Kurt has had 15 years or more experience as an asset manager and trading gas for utilities and producers in the lower 48 before coming back to Alaska where he grew up and sought to come home, and we found a place for him in the division. He's now our acting deputy. And then finally, Julie Houle, the head of our resources section. As I mentioned before, she's assembled a wonderful team of folks with decades of industry experience, some of whom have actually found oil on the North Slope as part of their jobs in previous life. And we've also just recently hired Nan Thompson to be head of our units section. Before her time on the RCA, she was an assistant attorney general and worked with our unit staff and is extremely familiar with the with our policies and regulations with regards to the management of our units. And so I am very excited about that. Bruce Andrews came to our division to take Pat Galvin's place as the head of permitting. Bruce has had worked for the Department of Law and also BLM, and is also very has an extensive background in environmental regulation. All of us have a role in Commissioner Rutherford's gas line work. It's the other 100% of our time is spent on that kind of activity, and we're doing our best to juggle both very large balls at the same time. And we're bringing quite a bit of expertise to the table. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Our next scheduled meeting will be at the new time of 3 o'clock on February 1st. I'd like to take credit for it, but it was our chairman that decided he was the only one that liked 5 o'clock meetings. But I'll be here in room 124, and I think with that we'll adjourn.